Jake Shepherd, founder and director at Synthesis. Jake, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Howard. I'm feeling pretty good this morning.
Excellent. Excellent, yeah, indeed.
Despite all the COVID news, yeah.
Yeah, and there is just so much of it that it's really, yeah, really frightening. And we're just urging people, please just be responsible. Just be responsible if, you know, don't go out unless you absolutely have to. It is not a joke out there. All right, the conversation that we wanted to have this morning is the impact that technology has had on your life now, and how you've managed that impact, that influence, because whether we are technologically drawn or gifted or involved or not, technology completely dominates our world, and many of us don't stop to think about what our attitude towards it is. So take us through your journey.
Yeah, so I think just in terms of like the sort of the game that I play, which is in the emerging technology field, many people say, you know, with the fourth industrial revolution, how's that going to change the world? And on the one hand, I suppose I'd like to be flippant and say, listen, I'm not a prophet. I can't predict the future. But on the other hand, I think we can't really absolve our responsibilities to actually try and understand what the impact of technology will be on us and on society in general. So while I agree it's really quite difficult to look into the crystal ball and try and see the future, I think what we can do quite well is we can look back in the past and see how major disruptions in technologies has like affected us in the past and then apply some of those lessons going forward. And I think if nothing else, we can at least take comfort in the fact that we've all survived the massive changes that technology has brought in the past and actually realize we're going to survive the ones going forward.
Mm, mm.
And one of the best insights in the books that I ever read on this topic was works by the guy by the name of Neil Postman. He was a professor at New York University for over 50 years. And one of his books, Amusing Ourselves to Death, talks about how TV has had a massive impact on society. But he also wrote a book later on, I think he wrote over 20 books, called Technology. And this looks more broadly how, like, we have a modern infatuation with technology. And then he looks at, well, how does that then shape the way society looks? And he actually suggested that with any new technology, one should confront that new technology with six questions. And really, it's not just answering the questions in terms of one's own life, but you should also actually broaden it and say, well, how does it impact society in general, like the political dimensions? And he starts off by saying, well, the very first question to ask when you're looking at a new technology, and it might be virtual reality, it could be machine learning, it could be anything. You say, well, what is the problem to which this technology is a solution?
Right.
And it's quite interesting. It tells the story, and we know the story that, like, back in like the 1960s, Britain and France started working on a supersonic transport system, and then in 1969 they launched the Concorde, you know, to the world, and they basically said this is going to revolutionize travel. But if you actually say to yourself, well, what was the problem that the Concorde solved? Because jet passenger airlines at the time could make the trip, let's say, from New York to London in 7 hours, and lo and behold, the Concorde could do it in under 3 hours. So it could save you 4 hours. But let's be honest, is that really such a big problem? And then the next question you have to ask yourself, well, whose problem is it? Whose problem is it solving? And in the case of supersonic flight, it seems to be the solving the elite business people that do these intercontinental trips.
Mm.
Or maybe it's like the Hollywood superstars that want to pop over for a shopping spree to Paris.
Mm.
You know, or for lunch. I mean, but like, whose problems is it solving? And the rest of us, less glamorous souls, you know, we don't seem to mind spending a few extra hours on an intercontinental flight that we take once every, like sometimes once in a lifetime if we're lucky, or a few times. So it's not really that big a problem. And then the thing he says, well, let's say as a third question, let's say you solve this problem and you solve the problem really, really well. What new challenges does this technology actually introduce and create? So what's interesting is when you look at the supersonic travel, like the Concorde, it created the problem of sonic booms as almost like a noise pollution that didn't really exist before. And the problem with a sonic boom is it can be heard from like 50 kilometers away.
Right.
So you can imagine every time a flight leaves, let's say, a busy airport, in a populated area, like tens of millions of people are dealing with this noise pollution. And in fact, the public complaints about the booms meant that the Concorde couldn't exceed the speed of sound unless it was over ocean. And that actually just killed half of its market in terms of the intracontinental travel, like, you know, traveling across the continent, you know, in the United States from the East Coast to the West Coast. Yeah. So that just cut that out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's really important is, like, that's a fairly obvious example. But let's look at something that's a bit more obscure, because new technology is actually often create very obscure, have a very obscure impact, and they create very obscure problems, and you certainly can't see, obviously. So if you look at the invention, let's have the telegraph. So all of a sudden, that meant that news spread across the world instantly. And before then, it used to, like, you know, guy on a horse, or a few smoke signals, maybe. But it was very hard to get information. Like, we almost forget that there was a time when information traveled slowly.
Mm.
So before the invention of the telegraph, news was really a local affair, and it was a neighborhood concept. And if, let's say, your neighbor's barn burnt down, no problem. Everyone gets together. We go to the neighbor and we help build their barn.
Mm.
In other words, we felt empowered by news. We could do something to solve the bad things that were happening around us.
Right.
With the telegraph, all of a sudden that changed, because now news started making us feel powerless, which is actually,
yeah, because there was nothing that you could do. You could hear about something. About, yeah, that's
nothing
so interesting.
You can do. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, how you hear about this earthquake halfway around the world, and you want to go rescue the people from the debris, you know? So maybe that's where the Concorde comes in.
Right.
But, like, I don't it really did some making. Us in a world where beforehand we were always empowered, and I think that's like quite fundamental, and it didn't become obvious immediately, but right. It's something that right. I suppose it made itself even looking back, it's not that obvious, but when you think about it, you realize, wow, news is something that's quite disempowering. And
so
the next question you want to ask yourself is, which people and what institutions might be most seriously harmed by a technological solution.
Mm.
And the example that I found fascinating is the microwave. Because you could say to yourself, well, who on earth did the microwave hurt? Like, right. What harm did the microwave do?
Right. It solved a problem in that we could heat our food or defrost our food very, very quickly. We could make meals. Solved a time problem.
What's the problem?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so if you realize that family cohesion depends on us spending quality time together talking as a family, and that is something that happens over dinner. And that used to happen naturally because of the effort and the time taken to heat the food over a fire or on a stove or in an oven. And yet the microwave actually radically revolutionized things, so you could heat food really quickly, and it made possible the whole concept of the TV meal. So unfortunately, this had the impact of undermining the family unit, because
it
made it possible for us to eat separately.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that is fascinating.
Then goes, and then goes on to say, like, you then need to ask the next question, is what changes in language are being enforced by new technologies, and what is gained and lost by such, you know, by such changes? And if you think about it, so let's look at, like, the modern internet age.
I was thinking that language definitely has suffered.
Sure.
Terribly.
It's had a profound effect on language, but let's look at the sort of words that get used. So the word friend used to be a noun. And now, thanks to Facebook, friends not only become a verb, but its opposite, unfriend, has also entered the dictionary. Which is fascinating. But I suppose even more significantly,
yeah, it's a loss other of words. Meaning.
Yeah, other words like community and conversation have also changed dramatically.
Yeah, yeah.
So it used to be that community implied people with different interests or goals who happen to live in close proximity to one another. Mm. And because of that, they needed to overcome their differences so that they could live together peacefully. So you learned how to engage, how to discuss things and overcome your differences. So in contrast, internet communities are actually made up with people with the same interests. And in fact, those communities become echo chambers.
Yeah, lesser than our communities, of course.
Yes.
They're not there for each other. They're just there to echo each other.
Exactly. And if you have a different opinion, you're cancelled.
Right. You're out of that community. Yes. Gimple says, what is FOMO? Fear of missing out. I mean, FOMO, yeah, absolutely is definitely. Well, all of these things are part of that. Are part of that age. D asks an interesting question. He says, or she says, well, Concord never solved any major problems, but it was cool. I understand what he is saying, i.e. you, Jake, but isn't some of it just for the sake of technology and exploration? Look at when we went to the moon. What did that solve? Except for many other unrelated advancements in science.
So I think that those are good questions. I think the one thing about what the Concord example highlights for us is look at any sort of new technology and actually say to yourself, is it really solving a problem or is it actually creating bigger problems down the line?
Right.
And then actually think to yourself whether you want to use that technology or not. Because if it's going to create greater problems down the line, then you can, in your own life, choose to ignore it. So it might be cool, but cool and bad also go together. And effectively, it's just to actually be much more aware of what technology does and the impact that it has. Obviously, in terms of like going to the moon, what's interesting is, incidentally, they did some studies after the whole moon program, and they found out that the repayment in investment was 7 times more than what they put in terms of new inventions and the way they actually progress technology.
Yeah.
So like,
so sometimes,
Velcro,
yeah,
came out of the moon program.
Amazing that. Carry on.
So another word, which I thought was fundamental that actually has changed as well, is the word conversation. And because conversation used to imply two people sitting face to face having a dialogue. And ultimately, they're resolving their differences and they're moving closer together. That's what that's what we understand historically by conversation. Look at today. A Twitter exchange is now called a conversation. And in truth, I would say that it actually does anything. The only thing it achieves is to drive people apart.
Yeah, it's the furthest thing from a conversation.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And then the last question he says one needs to ask is, well, what sort of people and institutions acquire special economic and political power because of this technology? And if you think about it today, who are the people who have tremendous power? And actually, I would say so much so that we're really in real danger from them because they've got too much both economic and political power. And these would be the social media giants. Because the danger is, like, companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter have the real ability to shape opinion based on what they choose to show you and what they remove if they deem it inappropriate content. So they can actually direct the entire world, almost like, you know, I remember there was the My Big Fat Greek Wedding. There was a famous scene where the wife said, the husband, he's the head of the family, he, like, you know, makes all the big decisions, who to vote for, the politics, etc., but she's the neck.
She pulls the head, where to look.
I thought it was brilliant. So these social media giants, they're the neck. They're telling us what to look at and what to see. So we really have to take a lot of cognizance of what's actually happening, with those. And really, whenever you're confronted with a new technology, use those 6 questions as a way of trying to unpack them. and try and understand them.
Jake, before I let you go, just go read us those or tell us the six questions again.
So let me just get them. So the one is obviously, like, you know, what problem, what is the problem to which this technology is the solution?
Right.
And whose problem is it?
Right.
And suppose we solve the problem, what new challenges does it create?
Right.
And then what people and institutions are most seriously harmed by the solution?
Right.
And then what changes in language come about because of it?
Uh-huh.
And who, like, who gains political power and, like, you know, who actually, stands to so to speak, gain? Who are the winners and who are the losers? One of the things that I thought would be quite a fun thing to investigate is, well, just try and apply this way of thinking to a new technology like a self-driving car.
Oh, that's fun. All right.
Okay, so not necessarily those questions in order, but, like, what insights did I gain when I asked those questions? And I think when cars drive themselves, I think we'll lose our intensely personal relationship that we currently have with our cars. I don't think we realize it, but we have this intense personal relationship with our cars. But it's because we drive them. And when they drive themselves, we're going to lose that relationship. And we'll relate to them the same way as we relate to taxis, as a means of transport from A to B. So I think what's going to happen is private car ownership is going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose some advice for listeners, don't become a car salesman. and then all cars actually will be owned by fleets. And the way we'll use them is, like, with Uber-like applications to order our cars and go wherever we need to go. And on a sad note, I think cars are no longer going to be sexy, because the reason they are sexy is because they need to appeal to Joe Public.
And we need to identify
managers who are making all the purchasing decisions. They want efficiency and effectiveness. And then the other thing to look at is, well, what's going to happen then if you've got fleets of cars, like, with directed through an Uber-like application? Those fleets of cars are going to be on the road for 90% of the time, as opposed to cars currently that are on the road for about maybe 5% of the time, sitting in garages, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to need a garage at home, and all of those parking garages at work, how's that space going to be used? And then the question you have to say to yourself, well, do I want to own shares in companies like Mercedes and BMW? And what about insurance companies that actually derive most of the benefit or most of the income from car insurance? And then lastly, almost like a personal level, well, with the loss of the car as a mega status symbol,
what's going to replace
the question it? How fragile ego is going to survive, and what's going to replace it as a way of trying to feed their ego? And I think that's, like, an interesting question to ask. So really what I'd really like to just, I suppose the sort of message I want to give over to everybody is that try and use these six questions as a way to think about all these new advances that are coming down the line and start thinking deeply about what the impact of these new technologies are going to be. I suppose to some extent be skeptical. So it might turn out that some of the new stuff is just like the Concorde, a great solution. You know, it's fun, it's exciting, it's new, but it doesn't really solve a real problem. And I think in the words of Henry David Thoreau, he basically said that all our inventions are but improved means to an unimproved end, which I think was quite a skeptical way of looking at inventions. And then I encourage people to see the world with childlike wonder and become really curious about our relationship with technology, both new technology and old technology, and then really apply your mind. So the two of us and the listeners, we're not prophets, but that doesn't stop us from asking the right questions. And if we do that, then I think that we can arrive at insights that seem to predict the future. And that's really what I want to leave people with.
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And,
Jake Shepherd, thank you. Unsigned says, absolutely fascinating interview. It really is. It just gives us so much to think about and so much to contemplate. And instead of just accepting the world as it's dished up to us, that we actually engage in it and we decide how we are going to be impacted and how the world can be impacted on everything that comes our way. It's 8:56. Jake Shepherd, founder and director at Synthesis Technologies, with a very, very interesting insight into the world of technology.